Here's a letter which Alex Southard, member of Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure, wrote to City on a Hill Press. You can actually read it in this issue of City on a Hill Press, and I'm going to read it. And I'm inviting folks to call in, by the way, if you have any thoughts on this, 423-5361. In a noontime press conference, CPRB Chair Bill Christie issued a press release and answered questions from media and members of the public regarding the John Dine shooting death of November 12th by Officer Connor Carey. Members of Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure, who were angered at the conclusion, demanded to know why public hearings have been ruled out, why no request was made for an independent investigation, and how the statements of 9 eyewitnesses who saw no gun or anything else in Happy John Dine's hand were discarded by simply saying the police officers were more believable because they were, quote, nearer. Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure member David Silva called the conclusion shameful. Nicholas Whitehead of Stop Police Abuse Now said, it's the same placid group of jellyfish we've seen before. This is a sinister disappointment for civilians. What is the point of having a review board if their starting point is to prop up the police chief's position, said Linda LeMaster. Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure researcher and writer Becky Johnson pointed out that the Citizens Police Review Board's review process was apparently so slipshod that Christie mislocated 3 key eyewitnesses, David Plumley, Stacy Bucklew, and Mike Schultz, in his description of events. Christie admitted that the board had made no attempt to see if Carey or Over had a history of complaints. How well Carey and Over knew Dine and what sort of hostilities had taken place between Newman and Dine on prior occasions was never considered. There was also no indication that the full board had ever thoroughly reviewed the non-police witness testimony on audio and videotape. Christie presented a little commentary on why some witnesses, the police, were believed and why some non-police related were not. The board delayed hearing the case for a month and a half, refusing to call for an early independent investigation in spite of widely reported witness testimony contradicting the police chief Steve Belcher's early conclusion that Dine was shot pointing a weapon at Carey. Yet now, if the report now claims it would be, quote, recklessly delaying, the board claims it would be recklessly delaying the report by seeking an independent investigation. Citizen complaints of excessive force by Officer Connor Carey and complaints of engaging in a subsequent cover-up by the police chief and the district attorney had been the subject of the board's review process. As the witness testimony of Ben Newman was taken as the official view less than 16 hours after the killing, the Citizens Police Review Board also ruled the shooting justifiable. Activist John Kaza said he would seek a writ of mandamus to require the board to use its open public hearing process in this case, the most serious in a decade. Veteran Robert Lee Patton commented that the board's decision was a species of political fallout, which he considered, quote, deception. Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure member Robert Norse commented, 9 non-police eyewitnesses in the DA's report saw no weapon in Dine's hand. Why does the CPRB choose to believe the accounts of Carey, Over, and Newman over 9 unrelated, uninvolved eyewitnesses who saw no gun in Happy John Dine's hand, 3 of whom called the shooting murder? The board had been expected to seek advice from an independent investigator whose work would not be compromised in appearance or substance by connection with local police agencies. Instead, the board repeated and reaffirmed Belcher's story of November 13th, made no mention of public hearings where the contradictions between witnesses could be publicly aired and considered, and ended with a series of innocuous recommendations regarding regulating toy guns and dealing with the, quote, mentally ill. Said Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure member Becky Johnson, the Santa Cruz Police Department has just been given a carte blanche to go out and shoot to death any citizen they like, as long as they remember to fire at close range, making them the closest witnesses with the best view of the shooting. This is a letter by Alex Southard to the City on a Hill Press of January 15th. It's a good letter, Alex. And good work. And shame, Citizens Police Review Board. Not so much that you made the conclusion you did. You have a right to form any conclusion you want. But you did so behind closed doors. You did so without allowing us to see the evidence. You did so suppressing the controversy, attempting to put a muzzle on it, instead of allowing facts to play themselves out, people to speak publicly about what happened, witnesses to be cross-examined, and an independent investigator to do his job, and for you to do your job. If you can't do your job when there's a murder, when can you do your job? Now, I have no doubt this is going to be used as a basis for calling for the abolition of the Citizens Police Review Board. I don't think that's what we need. I think we need probably a different process for selecting Citizens Police Review Board members. We need it from people who aren't simply hacks appointed by the city council. I hate to use the word hacks because I like a lot of the people who are on this board. They're nice people. but they're not good for this job. You have to be willing to confront the police department. These people don't seem to be willing to do that. You have to be willing to ask hard questions. You have to be able to hold an investigation of a situation where a police officer may conceivably be a killer, even if your district attorney tells you otherwise. And this obviously is not something that this board was willing or able to do. It's interesting. You know, you look at their recommendations that they came up with about, mentally ill people falling through the cracks. I think it's more a case of falling to the cracked. The whole focus is on the people, a category of people who somehow are responsible. It's John Dine and his toy gun. It's not Officer Carey and his loose pistol. No, it's not Police Chief Belcher and his cover-up process. No, it's instead the victim is blamed here. Let's have some legislation for dealing with realistic-looking toy guns. Now, what we need is some investigation about realistic-looking toy justice processes, or some kind of the kind of process we saw with the Citizens Police Review Board. And what about the mental health of the officers? You know, there's no consideration of what went on there. We don't know what they did with Happy John Dine in the past 2 weeks in terms of the prior encounters. I'm reduced to repeating myself. Let's see if we can get some new information from a caller.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hello, Robert. Very little else can be said. That's probably why you're not getting calls.
Uh-huh.
It's a nightmare. I mean, in Santa Cruz, of all places, we have a police review board, citizen police review board, that is no better than anywhere else. And it's the first time. I mean, this is an egregious case, as has been pointed out. I mean, it's as egregious as anything in New York where I came from, where all of these cases were, again, handled the same way. It's a monster that we've created, and we're building a $8 million palace for it.
You're talking about the police department there?
Yeah, yeah. In the meantime, the homeless go homeless, and priorities are screwed up, and we find that the FBI is spending as much time and money infiltrating the cannabis clubs as they did infiltrating left organizations way back when. I mean, you know, we have priorities that are so absolutely screwed up that one is left somewhat speechless, even when one is as verbose as I am.
Mm. Well, you're a talk show host yourself, if I recognize your voice.
Right, it's Mike.
Yeah, when do you do your show, and are you likely to be considering issues of police brutality?
I'll be going on about it Tuesday night, but not a great deal. Tuesday morning. It's Tuesday morning, 2 to 5 a.m.
And where? When
on KUSP.
And when? Where is KUSP, for those who don't know?
88.9, and in Santa Cruz City, it comes in better at 89.1, which is a translator.
Mm-hmm.
And I will probably not go on very much about it, because I did two shows very much about it, and what is to be said, which is what I started out saying, and now I've said too much.
Well,
it's a horror, and something, basically, the point is that this Citizen Review Police Board should be completely disbanded and completely reconstructed with some kind of teeth and some kind of meaning. This happened once in 10 years. Well, fine. That's what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, saying, well, it's only one case, that's kind of like, you know, the old saw of saying you're abusing your rights. What does abusing your rights mean? Either you have them or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You can't abuse your rights, and this was an abuse of John Dine's rights in the greatest, most egregious way possible.
Yeah.
They were taken away by death.
You know, ironically, this entire process is going to be used to, probably by the conservatives, to eliminate the police review board. Because the Police Review Board has power. I mean, it at any time could have called for an early investigation. It could have had special hearings in November. It could have had public hearings in January. It could have asked the city manager for an independent investigation, and the city council, as I understand it from inside sources, would have said yes. So it had the power, and it has the power in any case upcoming to do that. It just won't use it. That's the interesting thing. And the reason that it won't is because the Police Review Board members, are chosen by city council members, even the best of whom are incredibly timid on issues of police misconduct. Even Celia Scott, who occasionally pipes up here and there, and she's trying to essentially represent her constituents on progressive issues. She, I think, is really afraid of going toe to toe with the police chief on a lot of the stuff.
I think that this is a nationwide problem, and as I said, for us, it's the heart of the beast. For us, is Santa Cruz. We've created a monster. What is the purpose of all of those police cars in a city of 51,000? Where is all of this crime other than, traffic violations? I don't know. Where is all of this crime that we need all of these cops for? Mm-hmm. We are the only country in history that I know of that has voluntarily turned itself into a police state. We didn't need a coup. We did it with, I guess we had one if we count media as being part of a coup. And I definitely feel that the Republican Revolution was exactly that, and we no longer have the same form of government. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, we do have a police state that we have voluntarily put over ourselves everywhere in the country. Everywhere. Right. That's what's frightening.
Well, I'm going to give some suggestions as to what I think can be done, and I want to thank you. Is there anything you want to add?
No, that's it, Robert. Thank you for the show.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, tune in to... That's Mike Ackerman. Tune in to his show on... of course, I don't remember it now that it's past. I guess it's from 2 to 5. It's not KZSC. It's KUSP. That's it. On Tuesday mornings, and he shakes it up. How can we shake it up? What can we do? Well, in terms of this particular case, there are a number of possibilities. We were talking originally about an independent tribunal, and frankly, if anyone's interested in pursuing that or volunteering to help with that, I think Mike actually offered to be on the tribunal. We've had a couple of attorneys from out of town willing to do it. Give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, which is a phone contact for Santa Cruzans, for full disclosure. Frankly, we haven't gotten much in terms of incoming calls. People do ask me what's going on with the case, but I haven't anybody who really wants to do some organizing around this issue. So let me hear from you if you want to organize around this issue.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I called earlier.
Ah, yes.
And in terms of organizing on the issue, as long as there's contempt for the mainstream, it'll go nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the important lessons politically in the John Dine death saga are just that,
mm-hmm.
Okay, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why it died as easily as it did and why we tilt towards, quote, police state as much as we do is that a lot of good activism gets routed in a marginalized perspective, and it's easy to slough off.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are some basic tactics that can be used to raise public pressure and appease the mainstream, because that's the only real way things are going to change. If one has respect for the citizenry, for the individual, then they have to be reached. I believe there is a highest common denominator where we can reach each other politically. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the striving here, Robert.
Well, thank you, caller. Anything else you want to add to that?
I just want to stress that. One other thing, too, Free Radio. Free Radio's role in the unfolding John Dine death saga is very, very significant. Serendipitously, the phone line being attached, I believe, a week before the guy was shot,
mm-hmm.
is interesting. Free Radio has had a very significant role in allowing this issue to unfold publicly and I think some very profound ways, and it deserves a lot of accolades for that, as do you, Mr. Norris. This show is certainly well listened to. I don't think anybody needs to have any doubt about that as to who's monitoring this show.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, I want to stress.
Take that, Chief Belcher. Yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt that there's monitoring going on. There has always been monitoring going on, but certainly over the John Dine incident.
Well, maybe they'll learn something.
Okay, so people will look the other way. They will slough things off unless they can be reached in a polite, diplomatic, and meaningful way. This issue certainly is very crucial and important, and it can become a very, very potent political tool for all of us to learn how to be effective.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, caller.
You bet.
I actually think that most of this dialogue has been conducted in a very responsible way. I mean, we definitely have called a spade, and in my mind, a cover-up. But I think that we have spoken about specific facts and specific concerns and not attempted to, you know, cast names or aspersions, but to, you know, seek an independent investigation. We've tried. What are we going to do next? Well, there are different things we can do. We can come to the next city council meeting, which is a week from Tuesday. We can call them even now, 429-3550, and ask them to independently convene an investigation. They won't do it, but it may be worth the while just putting in the phone call. Here's an incoming phone call to us.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yes, this is Tony.
Yes,
I'm
Tony.
Actually someplace where I can call you.
Oh, Tony, yes. You're a cannabis club user.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
When are they going to put into service a brand new police review board?
Well, there are no such plans in the offing. There is an ongoing police review board, which now has a full complement of seven. They can be reached at 429-3262 at any time. You can call them. They've got a 24-hour message line, and they're open 4 days a week from 9 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon. You can file complaints about police misconduct by Santa Cruz police officers, though not by other jurisdictions. If you want to file complaints about other things, I suggest you contact SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now, at 475-2012. But the answer to your question, Tony, is we got this gang of seven sitting on the board right now, and there are no plans to beef them up or change them. Frankly, I think this issue is probably going to, I'm going to say bubble. I would say it'll sort of sit there for a while until the police do something egregious again, and then I think this issue will surface with a real vengeance. And I can't say what will happen. I think that, you know, when you delay or when you deny people just avenues of redress, then you get people acting in the streets, and you get people acting and forming their own vigilance-type committees, and people speaking up and shouting, and you get the kind of mass protests that, you know, perhaps are really what's necessary to get this process off dead center. I only hope it's a peaceful protest and not a riot, because, you know, when we had police misconduct at the New Year's Eve in 1994, when Lieutenant Patty Saponi moved in and started beating people's knuckles in order to get people away from the town clock at 10 minutes after 12, 50 minutes before the curfew began, she got a riot downtown. Of course, she was never reprimanded that we know of. Police force was never criticized. Instead, they used that riot to pass more anti-homeless laws. So the answer is we got the police review board we've got. What we have to do is keep filing complaints against bad cops, not taking a lot of energy to do it, but just creating a record so that whether it's through the actual way that police misconduct is reined in, I believe, is through mass protest and also through effective legal suits. When the police department gets a big lawsuit stuffed up its ass, then they get a little bit worried, and they have to kind of re-examine their policies. Unfortunately, in the John Dine case, and that's another alternative we have, is to try to get the conservator. I think John Dine's mother is conserved. She's lost some of her legal rights. She has a guardian or a conservator. Get that man to or that woman to consider suing on behalf of John Dine, and that would produce another forum for this issue, as well as possibly some real examination of police procedures. We might consider the mental attitudes of the police officers, their mental health, what kind of ideologies and practices they were engaging in and engage in every day on the mall in terms of homeless people and poor people like John Dine. Sorry, I had to get into that speech there, Tony.
Oh, well, that's all right. It needed to be said.
Anything that you want to say?
No, that's all I had to say was wondering about if the police commission was going to be replaced, but apparently it's not. So
not until we kick them out.
That's all the information I need.
Thank you.
Actually, that's something else you could do. You could call the police review board at 429-3262, and you could suggest they all resign. That would be one possibility. You can give your public statement, and you can do that 24 hours a day. Suggest that the police review board resign, and that you would like that message brought to the board, and call the city council and demand that they appoint somebody else to fill those seats, because obviously, again, it's not their decision that I'm specifically quarreling with. It's their process. I mean, I'm also quarreling with their decision because of their process. We don't know what the facts are because they've refused to go after them. Instead, they've accepted the cover story by the police department, which we know is wrong. I mean, even the police department is essentially no longer, the police review board says that the police department's cover story is wrong, that, no, he didn't have a gun in his hand, no, he wasn't in a combat stance, no, he wasn't threatening him in the way that was originally described by the police chief and the district attorney's office and everybody else in the media, like the Sentinel and the Santa Cruz Metro, for the first month and a half. Now they have the news story, which they're covering. What are the alternatives? A tribunal? Some kind of organizing on the streets? This actually was something we did soon after Happy John was shot. We formed a cop watch that actually didn't stay in effect for very long. We formed a second cop watch. A number of people like Skidmark Bob Duran and Josh and Vinny and others have always been on the streets keeping their eyes on the police and reporting through Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I think really we need to tip our hats to Vinny the V-Man, who broke this story on Free Radio, who was there within 10 minutes of the shooting, who actually was able to pinpoint some of the witnesses. And who knows, somewhere down the road, maybe his work will be able to have real fruit, particularly if there's a lawsuit that issues from this. There was talk about, again, filing a writ of mandamus. That probably won't happen until March, if it happens at all, which is, in my mind, a long shot, where I guess John Kaza, who's a local activist, you've heard him interviewed on the show, and you heard him at the press conference, discussed that he wanted to make sure, he believed that the Citizens Police Review Board process was faulty because it was closed. Unfortunately, that's how they view all their complaints. Unless they open up the hearing, they have a right to keep them closed. And, of course, if they choose never to open a hearing, then, we can't, critics can't say, oh, they don't have the power to. They do have the power to. They just don't have the will. Are there other bodies who could examine this? We could ask for a grand jury investigation under the able leadership of Art Danner. Good luck with that. We could look for an FBI investigation, see what they did with Judy Berry. We could ask the state attorney general, the same guy who's trying to close down the cannabis clubs, to investigate the police department. These don't sound like very happy alternatives. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't be pressed for anyway, simply as a matter of form. There's a possibility of suing under the RICO Act, Racketeering Act. I don't know, actually. That's more of an idea than a really verified idea. It's really, it's up to folks out there. I happen to think the best way to deal with this issue is to keep it on the streets alive by cop-watching the police officers, particularly Officer Martin Over, who I've gotten bad reports about recently. I heard from a panhandler and a street jeweler, and we're talking about a peaceful woman who panhandles regularly. She's out there with a sign. She hurts no one. Talking about how Officer Over stopped her jeweler husband repeatedly for having a display case of his jewelry, not even open on the streets, but walking into a movie theater. And how the Over had threatened if he saw him open his case once, he would begin confiscating his stuff, and he would also begin warrant checking him. It's interesting that it was Officer Carey and not Officer Over who fired these shots. One would have thought, based upon past behavior, it would have been Officer Over. As we know, Officer Over has been accused of drawing a gun on a man in August who was looking into a dumpster for something, saying, "Get out of that dumpster." He wasn't in the dumpster. He was pulling things out of it. I don't hear much about police officers drawing their guns in this town. I remember Sergeant Clark, when he was Officer Clark, got a reputation of... I wrote a story called "The Kicker Draws His Gun" back in 1988, when Officer Clark drew his gun on a skateboarder and said, "Down on your knees and say your prayers." And Clark went raging over to me and demanded I retract it. And I said, "No way, but I'll be happy to print your version of it and just take me to court." Of course, Clark never did. He then became the president of the Police Officers Association. I guess he's no longer in that position now. It's now held by Sergeant Andy Crane, who is currently being sued in court by Green Party activist David Silva. Crane threw Silva into a pillar outside city council last fall, effectively ending Silva's campaign for city council, because Silva was trying to present petitions to the city council after Mayor Mike Rotkin was ordering everybody arrested in that demonstration at City Council where they were peacefully locking themselves to furniture because the City Council was making it illegal for people to sleep at night and was refusing to consider any kinds of peaceful petitions or protests. Wow, well, there's a long chain there. Interestingly enough, I'm going to get to this. Today is Martin Luther, well, I guess Martin Luther King's birthday is coming up tomorrow. And there's a lot of stuff happening this weekend to honor Martin Luther King. There's a Western Workers Labor Heritage Foundation festival happening at 1:30. That's up in Burlingame. Mark Levy actually is going to be the folk singer whose song you heard at the beginning of my show is going to be playing at that festival. There was a meeting of the National Association of for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, last night, which I went to briefly. We were trying to get the NAACP to support the campaign to repeal the sleeping ban, which you may not have heard much about it recently, but we've gotten some pretty big hitters to support us. SCAN, the organization that elected our city council, CAB, Community Action Board, a major poverty social service organization in town. So we are really, we're doing pretty well. We've gotten people like Geronimo Pratt, Amnesty International Prisoner of Conscience, and longtime freedom fighter to support ending the sleeping ban. People from all over have supported this repeal, and we're hoping to have it ready for the streets. I continue to give this story every time I talk on the air, but the fact is that a couple of our key members have been really sick with the flu, David Silva for one. And we haven't been able to do the final work necessary, and we're hoping that we'll get done in the next 2 or 3 days. And that's a familiar story. But if you want to help with this process, and we do need your help, you can give a call to 457-9754. Is that right? Huh. I got to make sure I get that number right. Let me give you the Huff number instead. If you want to help with the committee to repeal the sleeping ban, call me at Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, still. I hope you continue to listen to us. I brought with me today a book called My Soul is Rested, Story of the Civil Rights Movement in the Deep South by Howell Raines, which is an oral history of the Civil Rights Movement. And it's a long, long struggle. And I want to kind of go back in time to a period about 15 years before people in masses turned to support the civil rights struggle in the South for black people, for African Americans. I'm talking about the early 40s, and because I think we're kind of in a position that's similar to that now, although perhaps worse, who knows. And I'm going to read you from James Farmer, who recently received, I guess, a medal from President Clinton for his early civil rights work. He writes about On Cracking White City. And in 1941, he was fresh out of Howard University's theology school. He hired on as a race relations secretary with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a staid, old-line pacifist organization in Chicago. And he says the following, he writes the following. In the course of my work there, I began studying Gandhi, Gandhi's program, his work in India in nonviolence. I sent a memorandum to A.J. Musty, who was executive director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, proposing that the Fellowship of Reconciliation take the lead in starting an organization which would seek to use Gandhi-like techniques of nonviolent resistance, including civil disobedience, non-cooperation, and the whole bit, in the battle against segregation. The decision was that the Fellowship of Reconciliation would not sponsor it and assume that measure of responsibility for its outcome, its success or failure, but I was authorized on their payroll to try to set up a local group of the sort I had suggested in one city, and the Fellowship of Reconciliation would not sponsor it. They would just pay my salary, $15 a week. Big money, I guess, in those days, while I was doing it. So then Farmer, the author continues, he convened the first meeting simply by calling together his friends, most of them graduate students at the University of Chicago, pacifists and socialists who were similarly studying Gandhi. And again, Farmer says, that was an all-night session, by the way, deciding what the name was going to be. And one fellow, I have no idea where he is now, name of Bob Chino, who was half Chinese and half Caucasian, came up with a name during this all-night meeting. He said, why don't we call it CORE, because it's the core of things. It's the center around which all else is built. And the problem was, what does C-O-R-E stand for? We then decided it should be the Committee of or on Racial Equality. A lengthy debate transpired on whether it was to be on or of racial equality, and my side won. It became of. Our first project was a sit-in, or stand-in, I guess you'd call it, at a roller skating rink that was appropriately named White City Roller Skating Rink, which is at the corner of 63rd Street and South Park Avenue in Southside, Chicago. This was in the ghetto, really, several blocks within the ghetto, but all white. Blacks were not admitted. I should say that at this time, we met and consulted with an Indian, a Hindu, a Brahmin named Kristal Nanal Shraddharani, who had been a disciple of Gandhi's in India, was with Gandhi on the famous March to the Sea, the Salt March. And here's a little something about the Salt March. Gandhi's Salt March of 1930 provided both a spiritual example and a tactical model for the civil rights movement in the South. With the march, Gandhi launched the campaign of civil disobedience, which broke the power of the British Raj in India. First, Gandhi announced that he and a few followers would walk 200 miles from the Sabarmati Ashram in the coastal town of Dandi to protest the British tax on salt, an essential in the peasant diet. Then, on the beach at Dandi, Gandhi broke the law guaranteeing the British monopoly in the manufacture of salt by evaporating seawater to make his own untaxed salt crystals. The British arrested Gandhi about 30 days after he arrived on the coast, but by that time it was too late. Gandhi's act of defiance had unified the Indian nationalist movement, and an estimated 100,000 Indians followed him into the jails. The protests ended only when the British made the first of the concessions, which led eventually to Indian self-government. So again, going back to James Farmer and his forming CORE and working to deal with this segregated roller skating rink, they met with this man, Kristal Nanal, now Shraddharani, sorry about that. He was at this time working on his PhD at Columbia in sociology, and his dissertation was a book analyzing Gandhi's technique, Gandhi's method. It was entitled War Without Violence, and this caught our imagination because that was precisely what we were aiming at. It was not acquiescence, as most people at that time, when they heard of nonviolence, assumed that it was. In this book, Shraddharani had outlined Gandhi's steps of investigation, negotiation, publicity, and then demonstration, and we adopted those steps as our method of action. At White City, we first investigated in order to confirm what we already knew existed by having blacks go in and try to skate, and they were stopped, of course, and told, I'm sorry, we can't sell you tickets. You can't come in. This was done several times to be sure that there was no mistake about the policy. Then we had whites, several whites, try to go in with no apparent connection with the black group, and they were promptly admitted and skated around. Then we had an interracial group go in and seek admission, and this threw White City persons, White City being, of course, the name of the roller skating rink, into confusion. Obviously, they were part of one group, so what were they going to say? So finally, they had to use the club night line, and they said, I'm sorry, it's a club night, and you can't come in unless you have a club card. And our group said, are there no exceptions? Absolutely no exceptions. Nobody gets in without a club card. You know, that's strange. Some of our friends are already skating in there, and we know that they have no club card. They're not members of a club. Well, are you sure of that? Yes, we're sure of that. We see them skating right through the door there, and one of them waved at us. So they then consulted the manager and everyone else and everything else and said, I'm just sorry, you can't come in. We stood in line for a while, and then we went back every night to do the same thing and finally tied up the line so that nobody else could get to the gate, and it became pretty rough. a little violence when some of the young white toughs wanted to skate badly. This campaign against White City went on for several months before there was a conclusion, and finally we were victorious. White City admitted everybody after our picket lines and standing in line and cutting down on their profit, virtually bringing things to a halt. They began admitting blacks. During White City, the thing was dragged on for several months. Somebody suggested, well, why don't we sue? Let's go to court and sue on the basis of centuries-old civil rights law. We rejected this because that would be reverting to the old techniques, which we knew could work under certain circumstances, but it would not tell us whether nonviolence would work here, direct action techniques. In the meantime, we sat in at restaurants. The first restaurant, which turned out to be the first core success, was a little place in Southside Chicago near the University of Chicago at 47th and Kimbark Avenue called Jack Spratt Coffee House or Coffee Shop, and we discovered discrimination there by accident. The accident occurred one evening after a core meeting. Farmer and a white member named Jimmy Robinson stopped by Jack Spratt to continue a discussion of establishing core chapters in other cities, Farmer says. The manager walked over and said, I can't serve you, to me. And I said, why not? He said, I just can't serve you. And I said, here again, I was going back to the old legalistic approach, I suppose you realize you are violating the state law. And he walked away, and I then called and asked him if he would give me his name and his title, his responsibility there. It was the implied suit of a threat, you know. We were not imaginative enough then. He then walked back to me and said, what do you want? I said, coffee and a donut. And he said, the donuts will be $1 apiece. Now, this was the day of the 5-cent donuts, or 2 for $5. I said, that's pretty steep for donuts, don't you think? He said, that's my price. Robinson said, I know better. I've gotten donuts here many times, and it's a nickel for a donut, not $1. So we went on and ate, and when I paid the bill with $1, the man gave me the correct change, charging the nickel rather than the $1 for the donut. We decided we owed it to him to return to his place of business, and we went back in a group of about, 6 or 8, and ordered food, and he thought for a while and then had us serve, and we said, well, I guess there's really no problem here. We put the money on the counter into the cash register and started to go out, and he raked the money off the counter, rushed to the door behind us, and hurled our money out into the street, screaming, take your money and get out of here, we don't want it. We left the money there, scattered in the street, so he couldn't charge legitimately that we had refused to pay our bill and taken the money or had stolen the money from him. So then we went into a session, a battle session, to decide on how we would proceed with Jack Spratt. We tried to negotiate then, the Gandhian technique, the Gandhian step. The Jack Spratt management refused all overtures, hanging up when core members phoned, ignoring letters. Two members were dispatched to try to negotiate on the spot without any appointment. They found in place of the original manager a woman who was apparently his superior. Hers was an argument which 20 years later would be repeated by white businessmen all across the South. She said, of course I have no objections to serving you personally, but it's just a matter of business. We're here to make money. We're not crusaders. We're trying to make a profit, and we wouldn't make a profit if we serve you because we will all lose our white customers. Still clinging to the Gandhian goodwill bet, the core negotiators offered to stand good for any money lost in a one-month trial integration. But finally, the woman said she was sorry. She simply didn't want to talk about it anymore. We went in with a group of about 20. This was a small place that seats 30 or 35 comfortably at the counter and in the booths, and occupied just about all the available seats and waited for service. The woman was in charge again. She ordered the waitress to serve the whites who were seated in one booth, and she served them. She ordered the waitress to serve 2 whites who were seated at the counter, and she served them. Then she told the blacks, I'm sorry, we can't serve you. You'll have to leave. They, of course, declined to leave and continued to sit there. By this time, the other customers who were in there were aware of what was going on and were watching, and most of these were university people, University of Chicago, who were more or less sympathetic with us. And they stopped eating, and the 2 people at the counter she had served and those whites in the booth she had served were not eating. There was no turnover. People were coming in and standing around for a few minutes and walking out. There were no seats available. So she walked over to 2 of the whites at the counter and said, we served you. Why don't you eat and get out? They said, well, madam, we don't think it would be polite for us to begin eating our food before our friends here have also been served. So a couple of minutes went by, and she announced that she would serve the blacks, the Negroes, which was the term used then in the basement. She would serve them in the basement. We, of course, declined and told her that we were quite comfortable. She then said, if all the Negroes will occupy those 2 booths in the back, we will serve you there. We declined again. She said, I'll call the police. Then I said to her, fine, I think that might be the appropriate step. By the way, we, still following the Gandhian motif, had called the police in advance, being completely open and above board, everything and notifying the authorities. We called the police department and told them what we were going to do. In fact, we read the state civil rights law to them. They weren't familiar with that. They assured us that if we followed the pattern which we outlined to them over the phone, there was nothing they could do to arrest us. They'd have no grounds for making an arrest because we were within our rights to insist upon service. We asked them if they would see that we were served, as they were obligated to do by law, but this they would not do. No, they wouldn't do that, but they wouldn't arrest us. So we said, perhaps you should call the police, and she did. Two cops came a few minutes later, looked the situation over, and said, why, lady, why did you call us for? I don't see anybody here disturbing the peace. Everything seems to be peaceful. She said, well, why don't you throw those people out on the grounds that we reserve the right to seat our patrons and would serve some of them in the basement? The cop didn't know. He went to a telephone booth and made a call. I guess he was calling headquarters to see if they could do that. Came out and said, nope, sorry, lady, there's nothing in the law that allows us to do that. You must either serve them or solve the problem yourself. And the cops then walked out. On the way out, they turned around and winked at us. We stayed there until closing time, and then got up and left and went back the next day a little bit earlier and stayed until closing time, and so on. Then tried again to negotiate without success. We went back in, several more times, and tied up the whole afternoon, tied up all the seats. They were doing no business at all. Finally, they cracked. The next time we went in, they served everybody and accepted money, did not overcharge us. We then sent an interracial group, a smaller group, in the next day. Everyone was served. We then sent an all-black group in, and they were served. We waited a week and sent another black group in, and they were all served. We sent individual blacks in, and they were all served without any problem. So we then wrote them a letter thanking them for their change in policy. At this time, this period in history, it was more the rule than the exception that places of public accommodation in northern cities excluded blacks. It was more the rule. It was quite exceptional to find any restaurant in downtown Chicago that would serve blacks. And we took on some big ones, Stoner's restaurant that seated, 500 or 600 people downstairs and upstairs, and we had such experiences as being served garbage sandwiches and having trays of hot food spilled over our heads, and some of the members were kicked in the shin by the owner and such things as that. Finally, all the Negro busboys quit their jobs in protest, and they hired Negro bus girls, and they finally quit in protest. Stoner's finally changed, but this took several months of activity, and they began serving everybody. Later, they went out of business. I don't think there was any connection, although we could never be sure. Were you having any success in the publicity component that you mentioned? No, we were not. We'd get a small item in the Chicago Defender, which was a black newspaper, a small article, and they would come in and take a picture occasionally. As I recall, they never used the pictures, really. They were not really interested because this was a rather bizarre technique to them. They hit you and you're not going to hit them back? What is this nonviolent crap? They had not warmed up to it, and we had discussions then with a number of Negro leaders at the time, and they simply could not see nonviolence. No, no. That is unrealistic. If they hit you, you've got to do something. Hit them back. It just won't work. White press displayed no interest in you? If we were lucky, we'd get a small paragraph on the back page of the Chicago Tribune saying, in effect, that a half dozen nuts and crackpots sat in this restaurant. They didn't say sat in because there was no such phrase then. Tried to get service in this restaurant, refused to leave, and stayed there for 2 hours or 3 hours or until closing time or until they were thrown out, whichever came first. That was all. But there was no TV then, no TV coverage, anything. This is 1941, I remind you. The thing that did not spread by itself, but we moved from restaurant to restaurant. We also had stand-ins in cafeterias. We had wait-ins at public beaches. And since there was no owner there to put us out or order us to leave, we had to confront hoodlums who tried to throw us out or tried to drown some people, literally. On some occasions, it was difficult to stick with nonviolence, so we did have training sessions. In those days, since we were comparatively small, we had training sessions in the discipline of nonviolence, using sociodrama and so forth, and our members at that time were largely young, largely intellectuals, and I would say more means-oriented than ends-oriented. They were concerned with nonviolence as a technique proving that it worked. We were not a rank-and-file movement, not a mass movement, and had not begun at that point recruiting from the, quote, lower classes, unquote. We were middle class, all of us, students. And he talks more about how by the following summer in 1942, there were three or four core chapters, enough to have a national convention in Chicago. Farmer was elected president. By the second year, there were chapters in New York, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Detroit, Los Angeles, Seattle, and San Francisco. We debated at each of our conventions, annual conventions, whether we were going to move into the South. This was in the 40s, the early 40s. The term we used was, quote, invade the South, unquote, since we were Northerners. I opposed it at that point, and we did not do it. I opposed it on the grounds that we were new. We did not have the support of the black community or the white liberal community or any masses. We were just a few individuals. I thought the violent reaction we would encounter in the South would be overwhelming, that the movement, the organization, it was not a movement then, would be destroyed and its participants probably killed if we began sitting in Birmingham or Montgomery in the early 1940s or sitting in waiting rooms or freedom riding then. I should say that there was a kind of freedom ride that was co-sponsored by the Fellowship of Reconciliation and CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, in 1941. 47. This was called The Journey of Reconciliation. This was stimulated, sparked by the Irene Morgan Supreme Court decision in 1946, where the court ruled that segregated seating on the buses was unconstitutional, should not be allowed. So this group of reconcilers rode the buses with the blacks sitting on the front and the whites sitting on the back through the Upper South. They did not venture into the Deep South. They went through Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, West Virginia. That was it. And there were arrests. In North Carolina, in fact, a number of people spent 30 days on the chain gang for refusing to leave the bus. That was in 1947. The organizations continued to be small. At one point, we wondered whether we had to give up the ghost because we weren't growing. It was hard to keep the chapters alive. We weren't getting any publicity. Oh, a little paragraph here and there. There seemed to be no interest in the black community or anyplace else. Nonviolence was still an unknown technique, and the word caused adverse reaction. It was only began to grow at the time of the Montgomery bus boycott of Martin Luther King in 1956. Actually, I believe it was 55. I think it was in 54, the Supreme Court decision, and then, of course, Louisa May Parks. That's My Soul is Rested by Howard Raines, which is a great oral history. And the reason I read it is because we are here in Santa Cruz fighting a civil rights struggle for homeless people. Where a lot of people attack us for being egotists or being loud and cranky or being out of the mainstream. But, hey, that kind of goes with the territory. And it's a long, hard fight. And nobody only happened 15 years later. And the struggle still goes on today. You know, there is massive discrimination against people of color across the country and in Santa Cruz as well. We saw that people of color are more likely to be considered criminals. They're more likely to be in jail. I did actually a series of shows on Ricky Prim and his fight with Cat and Canary that had him falsely arrested. And actually, I'm hoping to do a follow-up on that soon. I had promised stuff I'm not delivering on this show since we're nearing the end of it, but I'm going to invite the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz to call in. In fact, I'm even going to try to give them a call. Hey there, looks like we have the next show is recklessly moving in here, but I have 5 minutes.
Sorry.
So I'm going to just hang in there, and you can't force me to leave. I'm going to sit in here in the studio. I'm going to see if I can get Santa Cruz Tenants Rights Union member on the line for a very brief interview. If I can, reckless is not really reckless. She's just coming in from the rain. And This is fine. It's raining outside. We can't expect. We're going to see if we can get a brief interview. Hello?
Hi. We're on the line with Santa Cruz Tenants' Rights Union, Santa Cruz organizer Marco. Hi, Marco.
Hi.
Want to give us an update briefly? We've got about 5 minutes.
Sure. We're having a meeting tomorrow night at 515 Broadway, mm-hmm. 7 p.m. And we're still having spaghetti feeds. You can call us at 426-0644. We are almost drafted up the emergency eviction protection ordinance. We're ready to start passing that out, our own very own eviction protections ordinance. Donna's still working with the unlawful detainer project. We've been in court at least 2 or 3 times a week. We're looking and need volunteers for this unlawful detainer project to help people who are facing eviction, immediate eviction. We have a principles of unity that we're drafting up. We would like to share them. Pretty brief. We are opposed to homelessness. We'd like to see it abolished. And we would like to see a constitutional amendment regarding housing for all. And we want these emergency eviction protections. Those are the three primary principles of unity that we have right now at the moment. And so we invite you all to join us. We need money. We need equipment. We're trying to get a storefront. We want to get at least 250 dues-paying members, and we're talking about only $1, $2, or $3 a month. Please, we need this. We all have to stay together on this, and I'm really supportive of what you're doing here with the John Dine situation. It's really terrible, tragic accident that happened, and these gun-happy police have got to be curbed.
Have you... Are there any particular cases coming up around eviction that folks should be aware of or that they can help with?
Donna wants to speak on that.
Okay.
There's another case in Boulder Creek that...
This is Donna Dice, is it not?
...is suffering from substandard, uninhabitable living conditions.
Uh-huh.
And they moved up there from Marin, so they didn't understand the type of lawlessness that exists up in that area. And they found E. coli in their water supply.
And where is this happening?
It's going to be a court trial that will be coming up.
No, I mean, where is the house which is happening?
In Boulder Creek.
Boulder Creek. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the family's been living there for some time, and mm-hmm. like many people, paying a lot of money for nothing. So they have a San Francisco lawyer, so that should be an interesting case.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we can get the county to pay attention to the particular problems we have in Boulder Creek,
mm-hmm.
just as we have particular problems within the city of Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. And when is that hearing or trial scheduled for?
I'm not sure when the hearing is. They are getting together with us probably this week, so it's probably coming up pretty soon.
Hmm.
I will keep you posted on that. There's also another case going on. There's been an illegal camping trailer park on Golf Club Drive for a number of years. I don't know if you're aware of that.
You're not talking about Bob's Pine Grove.
Yeah, and the people are paying $400 a month. They're not getting electricity or any services.
Uh-huh.
They have to hike their own water and go out just to go to the bathroom. I think that's a big ripoff there. And they're going to be closing the place down the end of April.
And how many families are going to be made homeless by that?
20.
This is actually the only... even though it's had numerous code violations, the only so-called legal campground in Santa Cruz. We've had, of course, we have this sleeping ban and camping ban. They always tell you, well, go to a campground. Well, the only campground in Santa Cruz is at Bob's Pine Grove Campground, right?
And it's very difficult to get a trailer space, as anybody that's tried to knows.
Mm-hmm.
So, like this person who we advised to go ahead to go and small claims before they try to sue her, even before April comes, when they all have to move. She's going to have to move her family out of the county because there's no trailer spaces available.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the whole trailer scam was something we actually followed several years ago when California Homeless Civil Rights Action Network point person Laura Tucker was fighting some trailer group in Santa Cruz. But I'm really am out of time, Donna. Why don't you give your phone number again, and we can take up this conversation. I'm sorry.
426-0644. And one last note: Jesus Rodriguez was evicted on Christmas Eve
of
1997.
And he was convicted of.
Evicted from his.
He was evicted. I'm sorry.
On Christmas Eve. Jesus was evicted on Christmas Eve.
Well, history repeats itself.
I think so.
Thank you very much, Donna Marco. And
yes.
I hope you folks come to your meeting tomorrow night again. That's at Resource Center for Nonviolence?
515 Broadway.
At 7 o'clock.
At 7 o'clock. Also 426.
Everyone's welcome.
Every Monday.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's it for Bathurst Pierce Broadsides. Thank you, Reckless. She's going to be recklessly creating havoc amidst institutional dodos.
Talking about common law.
Talking about common law, no doubt. Well, she'll tell you about that. I was there at the opening stuff last night, and it was really quite important. I'm hoping actually we can actually use the common law to help homeless people fighting camping tickets and other petty harassment bullshit downtown. And we'll see how that works. Join me on Thursday at 6 o'clock for Bathurst Pierce Broadsides. I will return. Until then, give a call to 423-HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, for friendship and freedom and maybe a little support. Thanks again.
Please, Mr. White House, I can't afford a dollhouse, but you have many colored rooms with closet space to spare. Please, Mr. White House, tell me your house is my house. When I come to Washington, I'll move in with you there. please, Mr. White House, I'm living in the doghouse. The bank just came to repossess and took my house away. Please, Mr. White House, take your programs to the outhouse. Until the truth comes out of you, it's in there you can stay. Until the truth comes out of you, it's in there you can stay.